from Aspen Public Radio. This is Curated, stories on the artists who visit and live in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock, arts and culture reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. It is Monday, October 16th. Music and culture have long gone hand in hand. Just look at last week's John Denver tribute celebrations at the Wheeler Opera House, where fans congregated to celebrate the singer and activist. This week, we'll hear about a new venue bringing culture of all sorts to the Mid-Valley. We'll also check in with an ethnomusicologist about his research into the evolving music score of white nationalist movements popping up across the United States. Then a neuroscientist who studies music's impact on the brain has written a new field guide for critical thinking in the world of fake news. Plus everything else that's going on this week in the Valley. Thanks for tuning in and stay with me. The Temporary had its soft opening in August. It's the new interim space from the arts campus at Willits and is located in one of the warehouses on Market Street. So far, it's brought art house film screenings, front range comedy acts, and traveling musicians to its new fan base in the Mid-Valley. The Temporary looks old, but feels new. The walls are coated in a deep red with a light black finish. Chandeliers hang from the pipe rafters. Tonight, there are haystacks tucked into the nooks and crannies of the space. It's honky-tonk night, with the Caleb Dean Band, originally from Glenwood Springs, set to take the stage in Basalt's only entertainment venue. Tessa Lemke has lived in the Valley for 16 years. It's her first time visiting the Temporary, like many others who have wandered in tonight.
I think it's great. I think you could do a lot of different things. We're having a little issue with the sound right now, but I'm sure they'll get that put together in here. But it's really cool. It's nice, local. I think you'll pull a lot of people from Basalt and El Jebel and Mid-Valley and Down Valley.
Lemke is enthusiastic about there being a place for the community to come together for evening entertainment. She's already made the rounds with friends and met some of the people she sees in the grocery store from time to time.
There's not a lot to do in Willits, you know, after hours, after 8 o'clock at night. We kind of roll up the carpets down here, so it's nice to have something to go to in the evening as well. And looking forward to the artists that come into this space.
Ron Vincent has lived in Glenwood Springs for over 2 decades. He used to be a charter pilot, but now says he spends a lot of his time kicking it around his ranch. He loves these guys, and he's surprised by the number of people he sees here.
It might be a challenge to dance because it's going to be a traffic jam. It's going to look like the Glenwood Springs Bridge coming down here with all these people dancing. But I'm glad to hear they got the PA system working now.
He thinks the Temporary is going to be a great addition to the Mid-Valley.
You got all that stuff up in Aspen. You don't have much down valley, and everybody lives down here.
The Caleb Dean Band has taken the stage, and Ryan Honey, Tekaw's executive director, finally has a moment to catch his breath. When asked about the challenges in opening what he's anticipating to become a world-class performance venue, he says that, quote, no battle plan survives contact with the enemy.
We've been learning how to improve everything, but we've, you know, all things considered, it's gone really, really well. We've had great houses. Guests are having a great experience. Artists are having a great time. We had our first technical snafu tonight, and we got it solved. Everyone's having a good time.
From Big Lebowski movie nights to live music of all genres to comedy acts from Denver, Honey says it attracts a different crowd every night. Over time, his goal will shift to bringing these different circles together.
It's going to slowly but surely change the DNA of the community because people have a place for creative expression, and that's so critical.
In the coming months, Honey's working to continue bringing music and comedy from the Front Range to the Roaring Fork Valley. He and board members are also looking to expand the temporary's offerings to provide more unique theater and film opportunities, as well as lectures and culinary partnerships with neighboring restaurants. Of course, it's all temporary, in the sense that
right down the street is where we're going to be on a permanent basis.
Plans are in the works to build a permanent facility down the street with the help of the town government and private donations, bringing the nonprofit closer to establishing itself as a world-class interdisciplinary arts center that will continue to reshape Basalt and the Mid-Valley well into the future. You're listening to Curated here on Aspen Public Radio. Coming up, a cognitive neuroscientist shares his new field guide to combating the era of fake news. But first, ethnomusicology is the study of society through music. Benjamin Teitelbaum is an assistant professor of ethnomusicology and affiliate faculty in international affairs at the University of Colorado Boulder. He joins us to discuss the cultural changes that have taken place with music as white nationalist movements have gained more representation in the mainstream media.
Music had an outsized role in white nationalism throughout the West for a particular reason, and that is because the cause was marginalized from the mainstream so much. So you have all these activists throughout the West who can't voice their opinions in mainstream media, who can't achieve elected office. They can't get a critical mass of supporters out there that they could be a serious contender in the democratic process, let's say. So what do? They turn to symbolic expression, music. You know, if they can't achieve a victory in electoral politics, they could achieve it in the symbolic world of music. Imagine themselves as being more successful politically than they were in reality through music. So we can see music serving that sort of therapeutic, methodological role for white nationalism when it is marginalized. As the years have gone by, and this happens first in Europe, really, where small parties start to penetrate national parliaments, getting small but symbolically significant representation in governments throughout Western and Central Europe. As that happens, as media becomes more important, as youth subcultures in general surrounding music become less important, as social media becomes a main forum where people are exchanging ideas and developing political identities, then we start to see music making of all kinds, not just white power, but music making of all kinds starts to disintegrate. Because real power, more direct forms of influence and expression are available to the scene.
What are some of the genres that are more closely aligned with this particular political cause?
You know, in the 1980s and the 1990s, white power music became something of that cause's signature. That's punk and metal music with exceptionally vulgar, aggressive language and lyrics and sounds and looks. It's all tied into a skinhead subculture that was really the epicenter of white nationalism at the time. And that did a lot in the 1980s to kind of solidify this cause, to bring especially angry young white men into it. But it didn't do a lot to spread the message beyond that fairly narrow demographic. So in the late 1990s, moving into the 2000s, you start to see this proliferation of styles. And today, especially if you look globally, you can see so many different types of music being used in these circles that can range from, yes, punk, metal, all the way to rap, reggae, even big band music, singer-songwriter, kind of Bob Dylan style acoustic singer-songwriter music. So if you're really trying to track the role of music in these circles, you have to take that wide lens because there's a lot going on.
How has music played a role in prompting the white nationalist movement's wills to normalize?
When these activists start to use less stigmatized forms of music, less alienating forms of music, that to me is an expression, a reflection of their will to blend in, that they see opportunities, that if they change themselves, they could win greater numbers of sympathizers. But the actual engines of mainstreaming have centered more around media, in fact. It's been Twitter, Facebook. That has helped more than anything. Granted, there are a couple caveats that one could mention. YouTube, of course, is the, you know, can function as a social media platform, but it's also one of the places where a lot of music making today is going on. And the so-called American alt-right has factions, have groups that invest a lot of time in producing music that is produced and consumed for YouTube channels. We think first and foremost of a sort of a techno style of music called Fashwave. Tends to not have lyrics, but is traded and watched a lot on YouTube. Also some rap music with automated voices, sort of preserve the anonymity of the artist. That's being distributed also on YouTube.
What platforms are popular among these artists for distributing this type of material?
Well, I mean, the places online where that has become an issue have really been YouTube and Spotify. Spotify, after Charlottesville, in fact, claimed to be a large purge of white nationalist music being shared throughout their app, throughout their programs. YouTube has tried to flag white nationalist music as a means of controlling its distribution. They don't want to be enabling the spread of that music. It's very hard to do that, however. The classic case study that we see from this is Germany. Germany has hate speech laws that prohibit producing actual white power music. They even have laws that will allow their police to come and find you if you listen to white power music through Spotify, let's say, on your phone, on your iPhone. But what happened there was that there was this effervescence in even a new genre, you could say, of music designed to evade surveillance by the authorities, which ended up producing very compelling music that a lot of people wanted to listen to, of course, and adds a lot of fuel to the fire of dissidency of these activists seeing themselves as radicals fighting against oppressive censors and state systems like that. So it's difficult, really, to control political expression through music, and it's always been difficult. That's nothing new.
That was Benjamin Teitelbaum, an assistant professor of ethnomusicology at the University of Colorado Boulder. You're listening to Curated here on Aspen Public Radio. What's the story behind your move to the Roaring Fork Valley? Or if you grew up here, what made you want to stay? What happened the time you climbed your first 14er or wrote your first book? As your community voice, Aspen Public Radio wants to make your stories heard. Send your stories or pitches to claire@aspenpublicradio.org, detailing the stakes, because every good story has stakes, right? Something to be gained or something that could be lost. We would be honored to feature your story on a show like Curated. We'll ask you to come into APR Studios and work with myself or one of the other talented in-house producers we have here at Aspen Public Radio to bring your story to life. Don't worry. We'll make it as easy as possible for you. I promise. So let's get to know each other, because Aspen Public Radio is your story, your station. Dr. Daniel Levitin is a cognitive neuroscientist, professor, writer, and musician. He's known for several best-selling books, including This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession. His latest book is called Weaponized Lies: How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. He stopped by the APR studios while in Aspen over the summer to speak on the subject.
Well, I started writing this book in 2001.
Really?
Yeah. I noticed that the undergraduate students that I taught and a number of the high school and junior high school students that I would interact with at community science fairs and things like that weren't getting the kind of training in critical thinking that I benefited from as a kid when I was a student. I understand that curriculums in public schools change and such, but somewhere around 2014... after I had started writing the book, I doubled down and started working on it in earnest. And what I wanted to pull together was a real practical guide, something that everybody could use. And by everybody, I mean pretty much anybody in eighth grade on up could get something out of the book. It wouldn't be bogged down in theory. A lot of my work as a neuroscientist is theoretical, or we're testing a hypothesis, or, you know, if I tell you what's going on in your memory, I have to present it as two or three competing theories, and we're trying to figure out which experiment will tell us what's the truth. I didn't want to bog it down with any of that. I want a real practical kind of cookbook. This is what you do when you read a headline, or when you see a post on Facebook, or you read something on Twitter, you hear something on an NPR affiliate station. How do you know whether it's true or not? And what if your friends are telling you that it's fake news? What can you do to figure out for yourself without having to rely on others?
Yeah. And like you just said, and in the book, you kind of are stating that the line between fact and fantasy is being obscured, which you trace back to a flaw in the education system. What brought you to that conclusion?
Well, I think the flaw in the education system is that for decades, if not centuries, the primary mission of K through 12 education, kindergarten through 12th grade, was to load up young, impressionable minds with facts and figures. Things okay. like in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Right.
30 days has September, April, June, and November. All the rest have 31. Yeah, I mean, the sun is 93 million miles away. E equals MC squared. All this stuff, right?
Yeah.
But a funny thing happened on the way to the 21st century. We got the internet. And so these facts and figures, which used to be very hard and time-consuming to locate in a pre-internet world, are suddenly available immediately to anybody. Anybody with an internet connection, cell phone, pad, computer, right? So what we failed to do is realize that K through 12 education should be less about shoving facts and figures into young minds, because the kids are going to get it on their own.
Uh-huh.
It should be more about how to determine whether the information you're encountering is actually true and valid or not, and how to use it creatively to make society and the world a better place. How to leverage the knowledge that you have. There's very little of that going on, so we haven't kept pace. In the sciences, you know, I'm in the sciences as well as in the humanities, mm-hmm. in the sciences, things are moving so quickly. It's likely that what you learn in a genetics or a biology or a physics class isn't going to be true in 10 years' time. That didn't used to be the case, but the market for used genetics textbooks is very soft because they're useless. It's the same in neuroscience. So if you're training to become a scientist, you can't rely on what you learned in your college classes as being able to help you 10 or 20 years into your job. You need to know how to stay up to date.
Yes, I think that's a really important point. There's the other generation that maybe hasn't kept up to date with all of those changing facts.
That's absolutely right. And we're seeing changing facts in news. And this is another problem, I think. We've seen a balkanization of news sources, if you want to think of it that way. There are all these tiny little countries or fiefdoms that are putting out, you know, what they think is news.
Yes.
And in the old days, you know, we had, I mean, going way back, we had Cronkite, Edward R. Murrow, and we had professional journalists who were trained to do investigative reporting. And although they didn't always get the story right, they did their best. They took time to come up with the story. And, you know, when I was a kid, even when I was in my 20s, the news that you got was yesterday or the day before's news. It took journalists a day or two to come up with a story and publish it. They took their time. Certainly starting in the 80s with cable news and the 24-hour news cycle, there's all this pressure to come out with a story first. And that means that we're going to get a lot of inaccuracies.
Right.
And I think that as a neuroscientist, I can say that filling your head with a bunch of stuff that turns out not to be true is a very difficult way to operate your brain. It's not set up that way. And it's very difficult to pull out incorrect information once it's gotten in there. It's difficult to get rid of it.
Right. Your relatively new book is a field guide. And you actually pose solutions to readers to encourage more critical thinking. And you have chapters in your book that outline the steps that it takes to get there. Briefly, tell me a little bit about what you think a really good critical thinker is. What are the skills that they need to have? And how does that contrast with creative thinking?
Well, I think critical thinking doesn't mean that you cynically reject every claim. But on the other hand, we don't want to gullibly accept every claim.
Right.
We want to, I think, just ask some follow-up questions when we hear something. Who told you that? What was the source? Is it a reliable source? Is there evidence that might contradict that? And how reliable is that evidence? I'm not talking about turning every conversation into a huge production of fact-finding. But, you know, some things you can dispatch with relatively quickly just by asking the right questions.
Yeah.
4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate. Well, all right, who are these dentists? Do they still have their licenses? Are they getting money from Colgate? And here's another interesting thing. Yeah, I understand they recommend Colgate, but do they prefer Colgate? Maybe they're recommending a whole bunch of toothpastes. Sensodyne and Crest and Aim and Gleam and Aquafresh, right? That would kind of change the way you feel about the claim, wouldn't
right.
it? In fact, Colgate got sued for this ad campaign where they said 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate because in the public mind, that meant that they preferred it. Even though they didn't use the word prefer, it was slightly misleading because the public doesn't focus on the narrow meaning of words. And so, you know, they had to stop making that claim. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And I think that we all need to do it because there are a lot of people out there in the world who want to separate you from your money or are trying to take advantage of you. And the internet enables them to do that. Because it's easier now to have a platform in the internet age. Many people can make a website that looks just as professional as yours or NPR's or the website for the New York Times. You can make a very professional looking website which will fool people into thinking that you're legitimate, even if you're not. It could just be, you know, some crank. When I was a kid, we had in my neighborhood in rural Northern California, we had a crank, some old guy who had a little hand-cranked printing press.
Yeah.
And he would make his own little newspaper every couple of weeks and put it under people's doormats. And you could tell by looking at this thing, the type was smudged and it was crooked. And, you know, it didn't look like a professional operation, which doesn't mean it wasn't true, but it made you stop and think, this seems less likely to be true than what I might read in Time magazine. That's
right.
all.
Right.
We don't have those kinds of visual cues and clues on the internet like we used to, right?
Yeah.
To some extent, you could judge a book by its cover, if it was a professionally made cover or not.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the internet...
It's harder to judge the internet by yeah. the web page's cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was Dr. Daniel Levitin, author of Weaponized Lies, How to Think Critically in the Post-Truth Era. Andrew Sturtz is a Boulder-based folk singer-songwriter with some pop influences thrown in there.
He's bringing his acoustic set to the Marble Distilling Company on Friday.
This is an exclusive new song from Sturtz. It's called I Remember the Day. He says it's about breaking up in a bar.
There's no easy way to say this to your face. I don't love you now. I know it's hard to hear. I'll move closer to your ear and let you down. Oh, this was going to happen anyway. I remember the day I saw the fire burn and tried to put it out. We lost all of the house we built. You were not meant for me. Da 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 da. Da. I don't wanna drag this on. Let's go where we belong. Don't be afraid. Don't waste your time expanding our timeline. I'm over it. Oh, this was going to happen anyway. Now remember the day I saw the fire burning, tried to put it out. We lost all of the house we built. You were not meant for me. Oh. I remember the day I saw the fire burning, tried to put it out. We lost all of the house we built. You were not meant for me. You are not meant for me.
That was Colorado-based singer-songwriter Andrew Sturtz. He'll be playing at the Marble Distilling Company this Friday in Carbondale. That show starts at 8 o'clock p.m. For more information, visit sturtzmusic.com. Here's what else is happening this week in the Valley. Wednesday, the Aspen Chapel Gallery will present the Four Rivers Biennial Exhibition, juried by local artists Jim Searles and Charmaine Locke. The reception for this 29-artist exhibition begins at 5 o'clock p.m. Friday and Saturday, the Sopris Theater Company presents its production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead at 7 o'clock p.m. at Colorado Mountain College's New Space Theater. There will also be a matinee of this show at 2 o'clock p.m. on Sunday. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the Glenwood Vaudeville Review presents the production of its fall musical, Little Shop of Horrors. Each showing begins at 7:30 p.m. Saturday, there will be a printmaking workshop with CU graduate student Julia Klemma at the Project Shop in the Studio for Artists and Works, or SAW, starting at 10 o'clock a.m. Saturday in Aspen, the Wheeler Opera House presents Americana band Bumper Jacksons as part of the venue's On the Rise series at 7:30 p.m. That's all that's curated this week. For more on arts and culture, tune into Morning Edition weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. and visit us online at aspenpublicradio.org, where all episodes of this show live. I produced today's show all by myself. It was edited by Allison Bektash. Local musicians Greg Lau and Jason Patton wrote the show's theme tune, Omnicord Entrance. Special thanks to the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation, which aims to support the arts, community, and outreach. Continue to follow Curated APR on Facebook for news and updates on arts in the Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Thank you so much for listening. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.